Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.
This is Gerard Gibbert, and thank you for listening to Middays here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Middays with Gerard Gibbert is on the air. Middays with Gerard Gibbert is powered by CSpire. Power your home or business with CSpire Fiber. To learn more, visit supertalk.fm/CSpire. CSpire Fiber powers Super Talk Mississippi.
Get ready to go beyond the headlines and join a meaningful conversation with people from around the state. You're listening to Middays with Gerard Gibbert here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Everyone, and welcome to Midday Super Talk Mississippi. I'm your host, Gerard Gibbert, along with Will East in the Element Wealth Studio, guiding you through the middle of your day with facts, fodder, and fine music. Morning there, Will.
Moaning.
Well, man, what an event that was yesterday. Yeah. The funeral, the memorial, celebrating the life of Charlie Kirk. Incredible. So good to see so many people, especially so many young people, coming together in prayer. Not burning down cities and pillaging stores. Imagine that. That's the reaction. Come together to pray, to honor a person for his life's work. If that doesn't illustrate the clear distinction, in my view, between the right and the left in this country. And that's not to say there aren't similarly thinking people on the left and folks that are thinking up bad stuff, unfortunately, on the right. But in general, you certainly have to take stock of and recognize the fact that all of their response has been positive, uplifting, inspirational, optimistic. Even Erica Kirk, the widow of the slain Turning Point USA founder Charlie Kirk, man, her speech was unbelievable. She said he wanted to save young men just like the one who took his life. She goes on to say, "Our Savior and Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. That young man, I forgive him." I just couldn't believe that. That is maybe the most honorable, noble thing I've ever seen. I don't know that you would see that from anyone on the left. And I'm generalizing. I don't have any proof of that. I'm speculating. But when you see a member, Will, last week of the United States House of Representatives, AOC, go before the House with her speech justifying, if you will, why she voted against a resolution to honor his life, it just felt like a lot of hate. Very divisive. And she actually made a comment, I don't know if you guys caught this, that, you know, Charlie Kirk opposed the Civil Rights Act, which granted black people the ability to vote. No, it didn't. Where'd she get that from? She said that on the floor last week. Completely misstated. Now, how can you serve in the U.S. House and get such a pivotal historical event so wrong? And that's not what Charlie Kirk said. What he said was the truth. He said a lot about what we talk about on this program, which is, no, it's been hijacked. Now, people believe, as Rito likes to say, you have a right to be referred to by your preferred pronouns. And if you don't do that, that's a civil rights violation. That's not what the Civil Rights Act was all about. It is morphed. It is expanded. It is broadened dramatically so that everything's my civil right. I don't like it. Okay, well, you just violated my civil rights. No, that's not what it was about. And so he's right in that. The whole DEI, CRT, affirmative action movement, that all stemmed from the Civil Rights Act because proponents of those practices point to it. Yeah, I have a right to be hired as opposed to someone more qualified based on the Civil Rights Act. No, that's not what it said at all.
I wonder what Lyndon Baines Johnson would say about some of this.
Yeah, I agree. Of course, all this happened under his watch.
I wonder what he would say if resurrect him for a little bit and say, Lyndon, they said that the Civil Rights Act that you pushed in 1964, it's being violated when somebody uses
wrong pronouns.
He'd say pronouns.
You know what was... That's exactly right. What was more prevalent back then before the act was passed was there was disparate treatment, like in restaurants, for example.
Yeah.
You had to sit over here if you were of this race and over there. Use of the water fountains, bathrooms, the buses. My father talks about growing up in New Orleans and riding streetcars to work. And we're talking about in the 50s now, where, yeah, if you got on the streetcar and a black person was sitting in a seat and there was no seats to sit in and a white person boarded, it was a custom for them to rise and forego, surrender their seat to a white person based on race. That's wrong. You know, you have signs in the restaurants, color people eat over here. You know about all that. Heck, well, not far from here, UMC. I don't know if you're aware of that. I learned about this a few years ago when I got a tour from someone high up, I'll just say, at UMC, that did serve for a while as the vice chancellor of the university. But the original hospital, the original building, built in 53, 54, something like that, separate bathrooms for the races. And they're still there. But they're just men and women. It's just two men and women bathrooms. It used to be white men over here and black men over there. That's wrong. That's bad. Civil rights, for example, ended that. And, yeah, we should be ashamed of that from 60 years ago, 70 years ago. But we've progressed way beyond that. And the Civil Rights Act, is the point I'm making, it was designed to address those ridiculous disparities. Like, you can't go to the same bathroom. Well, that's crazy. Nobody thinks that's a good idea. But AOC, a member of the House, said, oh, yeah, black people couldn't vote, is what she certainly insinuated based on the statements. Like, she literally said it granted the right of black people to vote. No, it didn't. That didn't happen in 1964 in the Civil Rights Act. So it was about ending segregation more than anything and equal employment. But again, that's just been hijacked. That's turned into DEI. That's turned into affirmative action. That's turned into all these quota systems and all of these practices where a person's race and ethnicity and religious beliefs and sexual orientation is the key factor, or the key factors in determining various outcomes. Hiring, compensation, grades in the classroom, just down the list. Charlie Kirk was right in pointing out, no, that's not what it was supposed to be. It's not good enough to just be equal. It's got to be preferential treatment. I've talked about it on this program many times. We have the city of Jackson, where we're sitting right now. Their procurement policies grant preferential treatment to minorities. Now, we're not looking for the best, most cost-effective solution to whatever it is we're buying here, offer. No, no, no. We want to pick the one over here because it's owned by a minority. Well, that's wrong. By the way, taxpayers, you got to pay more for that. That's what Charlie Kirk was talking about. But AOC hijacked that, morphed that into, oh, no, he was a racist, therefore I can't support him. That's just sad. We should all emulate Charlie Kirk in his ability to carry on a conversation with people that disagreed with him, with whom he disagreed. Always respectful, always civil. And he would always work it from the angle of, you know, if I can make the case for a different point of view, perhaps I could persuade that person, especially young people who are so impressionable, so malleable. And that's the way he did it. You know, the most effective persuaders are those that are able to achieve the desired result where the party being persuaded doesn't even know they were persuaded, right? I mean, and he had that gift.
As Zig Ziglar used to say, I can't change your mind, but I can show you some new information.
There you go. And then you make your mind up. And so he did that. He exposed different points of view that they weren't accustomed to seeing and hearing and being exposed to on these college campuses, which are just jammed up with a bunch of left-wing lunatic liberals. He gave them a different point of view, and he changed a lot of minds. But what's, I think, most heartening is to see all the people turning to God and faith, something we desperately need in this country. When we come back, we've got Congressman Michael Guest. We'll get the latest on all the stuff going on up there in Washington on the Capitol Hill. Stay with us.
From the Seabrook Dot.
Now back to Middays with Gerard here on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It is Middays from the Element Wealth Studio. It's our pleasure to welcome now Mississippi Congressman Michael Guest. He represents Mississippi's 3rd District. Congressman Guest, how are you this morning, sir?
Great, Gerard. How are you?
Doing fantastic. So, you in Washington these days?
No, back this week. So, the House and Senate are both out of session this week. So, I flew in about 11:30 Friday night, and will be in the district this week. So
okay.
We'll be in Simpson County later today, Meridian tomorrow, the Jackson metro area on Wednesday and Thursday, and then Starkville on Friday. So I've got a packed schedule, but it's good to be back home.
Gotcha. Yeah, man. So in the meantime, though, as you know, we're barreling towards running out of money here in a couple of weeks. And the latest news on that front is that the Senate rejected both Republican and Democrat offers to just extend spending to keep the government open, stopping short, of course, of the normal order, regular order of the 12 appropriations bills. What's the latest on that?
On Friday, late Friday morning, the House of Representatives did pass a clean CR. It passed with it was bipartisan support in the fact we did have one Democrat join and a second Democrat who was not in the Capitol on the day in question. She did issue a statement that she supported the clean CR. So Republicans have passed a bill keeping the government open for the next 7 weeks to allow us time to continue to negotiate spending bills.
Okay.
We are currently in conference, the Appropriations Committee, on three of those spending bills, agriculture, energy and water, and legislative branch. And so of the 12 spending bills, we have gone to conference on three. We hope to work out the differences between the House version and the Senate version to hopefully very quickly bring those to the floor. But the Republicans, at least the House Republicans, we've done our job. Well, we've passed the CR to keep the government funded. It is a clean CR. We have sent that over to the Senate. And so now it's going to be up to Chuck Schumer and the Senate to decide, are they going to hold the American people hostage? Are they going to demand what they're asking for now is an additional $350 billion in new spending by making permanent the Obamacare enhanced subsidies that the Democrats passed when they were in power, or are they going to allow the government to stay open? And we, as Republicans, believe that adding $350 billion to spending in a seven-week CR is fiscally irresponsible. And so we pass that clean CR, we send it to the Senate, and now we will see if the Senate is going to be able to come to some sort of compromise, either passing the House version or send something back to the House that can be accepted by both chambers.
Yeah, that seems to be what the sticking point is, that the Democrats want to extend the enhanced subsidies, which, as you know, are scheduled to expire at the end of this calendar year. Those were, of course, passed in the American Rescue Plan, the first big piece of legislation passed under Joe Biden. And they're digging in pretty hard on that. I saw an interview with your colleague, Representative Kat Kamick, this morning, and she made the same point you did, that this is irresponsible and that it would include lots of additional spending, just adding that to the pie there, that for money we don't have. So
that's right. And Gerard, you know, Republicans have told Democrats that we would sit down with them, discuss in a broader spending package the possibility of extending some of those enhanced subsidies. But we wanted to also see where we could offset some of the costs. And the Democrats, even though those subsidies don't expire until the end of the year, the Democrats have said we demand $350 billion in additional spending to keep the government open for 7 weeks. And, oh, by the way, we also want to cut off the president's ability to use rescissions to claw back unnecessary spending. And Republicans are not going to agree to those terms. And so we've passed the clean CR, which is what Congress traditionally does when we get in this gap of needing additional times to pass our appropriations bill. And we now see that the Democrats are seeking to hold the American public hostage because they're demanding hundreds of billions of dollars in new spending.
How do you think it plays out, Congressman, politically? Is this something that is going to affect the midterm elections one way or another? What do you think?
You know, I think it all depends on the length of the shutdown, Gerard. If this matter is resolved without a shutdown, or if the shutdown is a matter of a couple of days, I don't see that it has a major impact. If this is, on the other hand, a shutdown that goes weeks without being resolved, I think that it could have an impact.
Yeah.
And we will have to see which side the American public blames. Do they blame the Republicans because we want a clean CR without the hundreds of billions of dollars in additional spending, or do they blame Democrats? And I think clearly this is a shutdown that will be caused by Chuck Schumer. I think he is in a political jam, if you will, because he agreed to keep the government open earlier in the year. He caught a lot of political heat, particularly from the far left, the Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, AOCs of his party. And I think now, even though Chuck Schumer believes in his heart a shutdown is not in the best interest of the country, I believe he is acting politically in what he believes is his best interest. And I think that we are barreling toward that shutdown unless Chuck Schumer and the Democrats in the Senate, unless they pull back and agree with what Republicans have put on the table. Again, a clean CR, no additional spending, 7 weeks. Let's work on the appropriations bills and let's get back to regular order.
Yeah, I certainly hope that. I think that a lot of people, as you know, I know you hear it in your district, would like to see the House observe regular order in funding the discretionary component of government. That involves 12 bills. It is at least a bit of progress, is it not, Congressman, that we got three in conference, right?
That's right. You know, this is the first time, Gerard, since I've been elected to Congress now, and I've been serving 7 years, that the House and Senate have actually gone to conference on a piece of legislation.
Yeah.
And so we are moving in the right direction. And while we are beginning with these three bills, I believe that there will be an effort if we're able to reach some sort of agreement on these bills, to then go to conference on the remaining pieces of legislation. And that is how, for centuries, that's how Congress worked.
Right.
The House would pass legislation, the Senate would pass legislation. If that legislation differed, they would go to conference, and they would work out the differences. And so we are just trying to get back to the historical norm, which, again, I think you're right. The American people want that, and the American people deserve that.
Yeah. Yeah, totally agree. So with respect to these enhanced subsidies, there do seem to be reports that there are Republican members of both sides that have some interest in perhaps a compromise, maybe not complete elimination, but maybe not a total extension of what's in place now. What are you hearing there?
Yeah, and I agree. And, you know, and Republicans have told Democrats that we're willing to have a broader discussion on these enhanced subsidies. We're willing to see if we can find a compromise. We would like to find a pay-for. And so if we're going to extend the subsidies at some levels, how are we then going to pay for that? And
yeah.
So Republicans are more than willing to sit down with Democrats and have those discussions. And we think that that is an important discussion for us to have. But again, we're not going to be held hostage by the Democrats saying this is a take it or leave it. If you don't give us this, we're going to shut down the government. And oh, by the way, we want to add this $350 billion onto our federal deficit. We believe that's irresponsible.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, as you know, Minority Leader Schumer believes he can hang whatever discontent there might be in the ending of those full subsidies on Republicans. That sounds like a big political gamble to me, Congressman.
He is. You know, he's gambling with the pay of our military, gambling with the pay of our federal law enforcement. He's gambling shutting down federal programs that many people depend on, again, because he is unwilling to negotiate.
Yeah.
And it would be one thing if Republicans have told Democrats, we're never going to agree to this. There's no way
right.
that we can reach compromise. That's not where we are. We've said we'll sit down, we'll talk about it, we'll look at seeing if we can put it in a broader spending bill in the appropriations process, but we're not going to use this vehicle, this 7-week CR, to allow you to spend those dollars without trying to seek an offset. And Chuck Schumer has basically said, then we're willing to shut the government down. We're willing to take our football and go home. We'll see if that position holds or not.
We're up against the break. Can you hang on and talk some more?
Yes, sir. We'd love to.
Great. We got Representative Michael Guest on the line. Stay with us.
Talk Mississippi.
Traffic jam, staring at the faces in a rear view.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays from the Element Well Studio. We've got Congressman Michael Guest joining us. So, Congressman, let's also point out and to discuss this for the purpose of our audience. Got a couple of questions on our ceasefire text line. That what we're talking about with respect to funding here, the regular order, or a continuing resolution, or, heaven forbid, one of these gross omnibus bills. We're only talking about the discretionary component of government, which is really divided into two major categories, defense and everything else is non-defense, that the Congress really doesn't appropriate the mandatory programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, obviously doesn't appropriate for the payment of principal and interest on our debt and in a series of other programs. And that discretionary component is only about 20% of total outlays.
That's right. You know, somewhere between 20-25% of spending is discretionary. The remainder is mandatory spending. And you did list, you know, kind of the major drivers of those spending on the mandatory side, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and debt service.
Right.
And so when people start talking about, you know, Congress and our ability to cut spending, and Republicans have, at least on the discretionary side, since Republicans have taken the White House, the House, and the Senate, we've been able to keep spending on the discretionary side flat. The mandatory spending is really the driving force behind the continued increase in the national debt.
Yeah, and that doesn't seem to get, in my view, the attention that it needs. You're aware, you've seen that latest reports coming from the trustees of both Social Security and Medicare, that they're placing at least the Social Security program to be at risk of not being able to meet its full benefit obligations as early as 2032, a short 6.5 years out without some sort of action.
That's right. And, you know, what we're going to have to look at then is we're going to have to then either look at cutting benefits, which no one wants to do.
Sure.
Or we're going to have to look at taking money out of the general fund, out of that discretionary spending, and then putting that money into the mandatory side to be able to meet those obligations. And it is something that has been building for some period of time. You know, the Social Security Trust Fund will quickly run out of money, and then Congress will then have to appropriate additional dollars to meet those obligations. So then that would require then further cuts to other discretionary programs. And so it is something that Congress needs to address. There have been conversations about establishing a committee just to look at mandatory spending, a bipartisan, bicameral committee to look at, hey, where are the ways in which we can save money? We know that the increased health care costs are a major driver of spending.
Yeah.
And so what can we do as a federal government to make sure that we are providing good quality health care, but doing so at the lowest cost possible? And again, as we've seen interest rates grow up, as we've seen borrowing go up, particularly over the last 4 years under Joe Biden, that has driven up the cost of debt service. Now we pay more in debt service than we do to fund our military. And so that is, debt service is larger than any item that we appropriate on the discretionary spending side. And so what can we do to bring in additional revenues without raising taxes? And people say, well, how do you do that? Well, I mean, you and I know you grow the economy. If you grow the economy, if people are making more money, then you can keep the tax rate at the current rate, and you can actually bring in additional revenues to the federal government. And we as Congress, we have to have the foresight not to spend those dollars, not to appropriate those dollars to other programs, but instead to use that additional revenue to pay down the national debt.
Yeah, and we got to get to a point where we're not producing these $2 trillion deficits. You've seen the latest data there that we're at $1.9 trillion through August with 1 month remaining in the fiscal year. If September comes in close to what September 24 was, we're going to be at the 2-1-2-2 deficit mark.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. Now, I will say that under Republican control, that Republicans actually spent, I believe it was $7 billion less in FY25 than we did in FY24. We also know that we passed a $9 trillion rescissions package on top of that. And so while those numbers aren't huge, we do see that with the Republicans controlling both houses of Congress, we are working diligently to keep federal spending on the discretionary side flat. With the goal then is, now that we have flattened that curve, what can we do to decrease discretionary spending? And then also, how do we tackle the mandatory spending again, which is the largest driver of our federal deficit?
Right. Well, hopefully you guys will start having some discussions in earnest about that, because as it stands right now, we're on a trajectory so that in 2032, Social Security will only be able to meet about 75% of its benefit payments. I mean, it's just a short 6.5 years out.
Well, and just about the time that I would be eligible for Social Security, we see that the program is going to reach that breaking point. And so, look, Social Security is an important program. It's an important program because it supports so many people in our state. My parents are currently drawing Social Security. My mother-in-law is on Social Security. I hope to be someone who can draw Social Security one day because I have paid into the system since I was actually started being an hourly employee at age 16, working in the summers for the city of Brandon at the Parks and Recreation Department. And so it's important that we honor those commitments that we've made to our seniors, but we also have to make sure that we are keeping a careful and close eye on our deficit spending because that is going to continue to serve as a drain on our economy. And as we have these conversations, I know, Gerard, you and I have talked before about these things. Would love to continue to hear your input, your suggestions, to take those back to Washington and try to advocate for some of those positions.
Yeah, we should certainly talk about that because it's a real problem. Before we go here, we got a few minutes left. This Charlie Kirk situation, man, what'd you think about the memorial, the funeral yesterday, and the headline of the president, the vice president, members of the cabinet? I particularly enjoyed Stephen Miller's speech. I don't know if you caught that, but he pegged it, I thought.
You know, I mean, I think what we saw yesterday was an incredible tribute to the life of Charlie Kirk. For his widow, Erica, to come out and say that she has forgiven the gunman that killed her husband, I thought that that was strong. I thought that was powerful to see the number of people that came out and really supported the life of Charlie Kirk. I think it goes to show that his message, that his influence will live on long after his passing. You know, I tell you one thing that I was disappointed in, not regarding the service, but I was disappointed in that on Friday there was a vote taken in the House of Representatives on a resolution that was honoring Charlie Kirk and condemning violence
political violence arena. Yeah.
That's right, condemning political violence. And what we saw is every Republican voted to support that. But less than half the Democrats voted to support that. 95 voted to support it. There were 58 who voted against supporting. There were 38 who voted present. Another 22 who didn't vote at all. And then we saw Jasmine Crockett, the very controversial representative who is a member of the squad. She came out in public statements that she's made and said she was upset that there were more Democrats who didn't vote to condemn this political violence.
Right.
And so in an era where you have people say, hey, we need to bring down the temperature, you know, we need to do what we can to come back to having civility within between the parties as we look to fund the government, as we look to pass laws in our nation's capital, we see that those on the Democrat side, many refuse to vote for a resolution condemning violence. And then Jasmine Crockett is actually trying to call out members of her party who did vote to do
right.
that. And so how do we get back to the point then of being able to work together? How do we bring down the temperature when Democrats refuse to condemn political violence because of their hatred of Charlie Kirk and their hatred of his conservative message?
Were you present when AOC spoke for what appeared to be a long period of time? And I talked about it earlier on the program when she said that she couldn't support the resolution because we got about a minute left that Kirk has denounced the Civil Rights Act. And then she went on to say it's the Civil Rights Act that granted voting rights to minorities, to black people in this country. That's not true.
Well, clearly it shows her lack of knowledge of American history. Again, someone gave her a talking point that she tried to use to condemn Charlie Kirk. And that's all that the far left have used. They don't know their history. They take talking points that are fed to them, and then they make themselves look foolish at times.
Unbelievable.
Just, again, very disappointed in my Democrat colleagues who did not vote to support the resolution condemning political violence.
Absolutely. Appreciate you coming on, Congressman. Always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Gerard.
We're coming right back in the Element Well studio.
Hey, this is Bob. Just
too much for the man. He could make it.
So he's leaving the light. He's come to know. Ooh.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. I believe that the Democrat socialist candidate for mayor in New York, well, Zoran Mamdani, has secured the endorsement of Hakeem Jeffries, right?
Yeah, they've been negotiating that for a little while, from what I understand. Now, what they had to negotiate about, I have no idea.
I don't either. Kathy Hochul, the governor, as well, right, of
yes.
New York, has come out. But I believe it's the head of the Democratic Party apparatus in the state of New York will not. Says disagrees with many
Which
of his policies.
Just goes to tell you.
How messed up is that, man? Just incredible. Your money, the NASDAQ's up 61 points. The Dow all over the unchanged lines. Been up, down, up, down as we speak, as a matter of fact. Funny money up to 112,000 today. The 10-year Treasury, that's important because the yield on that is what drives mortgage and auto loan rates and other big lending rates. And it's in the 4.1 range. So really hasn't reacted downward after the Fed cut the benchmark Fed funds rate by a quarter of a point last week. So that's kind of where we are there. On the ceasefire text line, I had someone that said, this is John, yeah, he says, Senate and Congress should not be allowed recess until the job is done, starting to border on lazy, considering they took off all of August, and that includes Mr. Guest. Well, I hear you talking about the budget. So, again, keep in mind, they're only appropriating, and this is important, but I think it's important to distinguish between the fact that the Congress only appropriates about 20-22% of total spending. The rest of it does not require any action on the part of Congress. The 75-78, almost 80% now. And that figure continues to increase because our debt goes up and our debt service goes up. Thus, the mandatory side of spending is increasing and consuming more of the total, up to nearly 80%. So the Congress is only dealing with roughly 20-22% of the total. And it does require any legislation to fund the discretionary functions of government. That legislation requires filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. So you got to get some Democrats to join in with Republicans to keep everything going. At this point, it looks to me pretty much a foregone conclusion that we're poised for a shutdown. Now, that's usually overblown, what you hear as complaints about what would happen if we experienced a shutdown is grossly exaggerated. Does it mean that Social Security and Medicare benefits, for example, those don't stop? There would get a point where, without having the Social Security administrative staff and the Medicare administrative staff in place, that would cause some pain for people. It doesn't stop us paying our Treasury principal and interest. It doesn't stop veterans' benefits, but it could cause lots of other pain. And of course, you're all going to get back pay once funding is restored. But the controversial issue is what to do about, as you heard the congressman talk about, these enhanced subsidies passed in the American Rescue Plan in the Obamacare exchanges, in the also called marketplaces, the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Some 24 million Americans currently enrolled in the exchange. That includes 340,000 in the state of Mississippi. So they're subject to, they're going to see, no doubt about it, they're going to see higher premiums once the enhanced subsidies expire at the end of this year. And there's a lot of people right now, Will, you know this, that don't even know this is about to hit them. They're not keeping up with this, and I don't blame them. No, you shouldn't have to, honestly. But when they're going to get their notices for re-enrollment, and they're going to see that, wow, my premiums spiked because the subsidies. You got the combination of insurers charging more for premiums. That's across the board in the country, and the subsidies going down. That's kind of a double whammy to their out-of-pocket costs for health insurance. Again, 340,000 in Mississippi, industry analysts estimate that about 75 to 80,000 Mississippians will drop their coverage altogether.
Wow.
And if that happens, generally speaking, that means the insurance companies pass on the provider costs to those of us who do have commercial insurance. That's usually what happens as a result of that.
Because people are still going to go to the ER.
Yeah, they're still going to get medical care. That's right. You're just not going to pay for it. So somebody's going to pay for that. And that's the risk of what's going on here. What a mess all this is, man. It's been a mess for a long time that we can't seem to solve. It's top of the hour. That means Fox News, Super Talk News coming your way. We've got another hour of middays remaining, and then Super Talk Outdoors with Ricky Matthews at 12:05.
Your hour of middays with Gerard Gibbert is brought to you by the Mississippi Business Journal. Visit msbusinessjournal.com. Scott Coopwood, publisher and president.
And now. Another hour of the talk that keeps Mississippi talking. Middays with Gerard Gibbert.
Begin your transmission now.
Now on Super Talk Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's hour two of Middays. We are coming at you from the Element Well studio. Call Element Wealth at 601-957-6006 or check out their website at myelementwealth.com to let them help you find your balance between income, growth, and guarantees. The Dow now in the green, looks like they may be, all indexes are right now. The S&P 500 on pace for the 28th record close in 2025. There's lots of optimism, Will, out there among investment analysts and those who track the economy and things going on. It's just a lot of good feelings about where we are in the American economy right now. The one thing that's kind of hanging out there is the state of the labor market, a little weak. And I think that's what prompted the Fed last week to dial back the benchmark interest rate there. Of course, one of their mandates, congressional mandates, price stability and maximum employment. They're consuming a lot of the employment data to the extent they can rely on it. You know, I've never been confident in what comes out of the BLS and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And a couple of months ago, the president finally had enough, too, and said, yeah, we got to make some changes there. You can't get accurate information. And whatever you get, it's always revised, not by a little, by a lot. And so policymakers, the Fed, that are relying on this information for their monetary policy are finding that it's somewhat unreliable. But overall, I think it's safe to say that the job market is kind of weak right now. Lots of reports about college graduates saying, yeah, I'm going to go to graduate school. I can't find a job. So,
yeah.
All this is going on. I saw a report over the weekend. You may have seen this, where some of the technology leaders are predicting that the advent of artificial intelligence may take us to a 3-day work week. How about that? I think Elon Musk was among them that also is seeing this in our future. 3-day work week. Zoom's CEO, Jensen Huang, at NVIDIA. Bill Gates also among those who see that as a possibility. There's already a big move in this country to transition to a 4-day work week. In fact, the Democrats in Congress wanted to change the rules around overtime policy. To base on 32 hours as a standard work week as opposed to 40, and any work over the 32 would be paid at overtime rates, would be considered overtime. So
I'm a little pessimistic about that happening.
Yeah.
Because of AI. Over the weekend, I was looking up some information about Ole Miss and Mississippi State, and AI couldn't tell the difference between Ole Miss and Mississippi State. So, Until they fix some of those things, I think we're going to be a little safe. Now, there are some cool things, obviously, that happen because of it. It does speed up some stuff, but it still has some fundamental things that and I was using, by the way, I wasn't just using, you know, the old ChatGPT. I was using the advanced Grok.
Yeah.
That couldn't tell the difference between Ole Miss and Mississippi State.
Oh, well. I mean, it's obviously not perfect.
Exactly. And neither are humans, of
that's
course.
Right. And it requires some review and some care in the output that's produced, but it's still a whole heck of a lot faster than digging into it yourself. Now, what I like to do, just kind of to verify what is returned, and I like Gemini, but I review the underlying data. A lot of times it's reports, it's white papers, it's analyses, it's articles, and I'll dig into that to make sure that they consumed and analyzed and summarized correctly. But I like the bullet point form in particular that Gemini generates. It's pretty powerful. But you're right. You can't take it at face value. You've got to be a little careful. The other thing I found is, like, when I'm trying to get information about changes in policy or law or legislation, that often what will get presented is dated. That what you get right is a report of something that, yeah, that was true until something else changed it, amended it, overrode it, updated it. You got to be careful with that.
Yeah.
Won't be current. So,
but yeah, the labor market definitely. I mean, it seems like a lot of companies are in this. We're not firing anybody, but we're not hiring anybody either.
That's right. And manufacturing jobs in particular, which I've never agreed with as being a litmus test for the state of the economy, but the politicians are still stuck in the 50s and 60s, all about manufacturing jobs, which have been on the decline as a percentage of our overall workforce for decades. In fact, I think it was at its highest, if I'm not mistaken, in the 70s, and it's been on a decline since then. But that's not because we don't have as much manufacturing as much as it is. No, we've just invented a whole lot of new industries that didn't even exist. And our economy is one based on services. And as a result of that, we're wealthier than countries that are still relying on manufacturing as their primary industry in their overall GDP ecosystem. We've invented all sorts of new forms of services that didn't even exist a few years ago. So that's what's going on. John on the C Spire text line thinks that the members of Congress should be compelled to get up to Washington and take care of this budget. And he says, what can we do to force them to do their job? So I just said, keep in mind, this is not a partisan matter. That when the Democrats are in charge, it's the Republicans that generally object to what the Democrats want to do in the way of spending. And this is why we can't pass a comprehensive budget. Because there's just no agreement. So the best we can do is get by budget, I mean for the entirety of government, the best we can do is just get some mechanism to fund the discretionary component. And as we were talking about with the congressman, you heard him say it, Will. It's the first time that at least three of the 12 bills have made it to conference, meaning both sides, the Senate and the House, will negotiate. He's never had that. In his, what do you say, 8 years of serving in the House, we can't get to that point. So that's three of the 12. The other nine, they can't get to that level. So, look, the Democrats believe they're doing what their constituents sent them to do, and the Republicans are believing what theirs. The reality is we just don't agree on anything from a party perspective. There's just, we can't even agree on a resolution honoring the life of a husband and a father who was assassinated in front of the world to see. We can't even agree on that. So how are we going to agree on complex spending policy when you're talking about, in this case, the discretionary component of spending about $1.9 trillion? Yeah. We got no chance of agreeing on that. We can't agree, right, that a man can't get pregnant. We can't agree on something fairly fundamental. So digging into the weeds of 3,000-page bills to fund the government is Seems like a tall order. So I guess I would say, so to John, and I hear you, man. It is frustrating to me, too. He says they need to do their job, and this is what I'll tell you, John. Both sides think they're doing their job. The Democrats believe right now that standing in the way of the Republican budget is doing their job. And the Republicans believe that insisting that Democrats sign on, since they're in charge, since they have both houses, that they're doing their job. But the way our system works, you got to have some Democrats peeled off in the Senate to support what the Republican House sends over to pass it. We can't get but three of the 12 bills to conference. And that's the first time in 8 years. That's how divided we are. And again, the question here is, the controversial matter is, we have a deadline. And deadlines always cause chaos. But the deadline is these enhanced subsidies that millions, tens of millions of Americans have been enjoying now since 2021 are going away at the end of the year. And the Democrats want to extend them. And for the most part, Republicans want to end them. But you heard the congressman. There's some interest, perhaps, in a compromise. Senator Josh Hawley over there in the Senate, he actually said that he's in favor of extending the enhanced subsidy. So there's no consensus among Republicans, for sure. I think there's pretty good chance there's broad consensus among Democrats. Yep, we got to extend them as is, in full. When we come back, since we're talking about all this money and spending, I want to talk about how the pay-go rules could affect Medicare. Medicare. Stay with us. We're coming right back. We're in the Element Well studio. Everyone, it's middays from the Element Well studio. We appreciate you joining us. So, PAYGO. This is federal legislation that could impact the Medicare program. It's a budget rule that Congress passed some time ago. I want to say it's maybe 2010 or something like that. To offset the cost, requires Congress to offset the cost of any new legislation that increases the federal deficit. So in this case, if Congress passes a law that adds to the deficit and they do not waive the pay-go rule, the Office of Management and Budget is required to apply across-the-board cuts to certain federal programs to compensate. Medicare would be in the crosshairs, and that it is one of the programs that would be cut under the PAYGO rules by 4%. Now, of course, Medicare is not like Social Security. It's not; it doesn't consist of cash payments that go to those enrolled. Rather, it pays the providers of medical services to Medicare subscribers. And so what this would mean is that providers would get payment cuts. Hospitals, physicians, nursing homes, Medicare Advantage programs, all the above. So that's lower reimbursement to providers. And it is expected that if Congress doesn't do something, that many providers would just drop Medicare, would just get out of the Medicare program, meaning that you could still receive medical treatment and services from the provider, your doctor, but you'd have to pay, generally speaking, at when services are rendered, and then you'd have to file the claim with Medicare and then wait. Well, that's quite a problem for a lot of people that just don't have the means to make a payment like there, right there when the services are rendered. So that's what's going on. Now, there's something I don't know that I've ever talked about on this program, but when I first got involved in politics back in 2008, which was driven by the Affordable Care Act and Barack Obama's plans for health care because of how it was going to affect those of us in the business world. Well, I learned as part of the research and just review of health care policy, there's this kind of provision that has sort of a slang name. Well, it's called the doctor fix. I don't know if you've ever heard of that before. Yeah, most people are not familiar with that. So, believe it or not, Congress passed an act in 2015 that would have reduced Medicare payments to providers. 2015, 10 years ago. And every year since then, the Congress acts and says, no, we can't do that. And they pass legislation called the doctor fix, meaning, yeah, we're going to keep paying them what we're paying them. We're not going to reduce the amount being paid, which is affects, of course, federal spending. And that has been a problem for a long time, the doctor fix. Actually, it went from 20, I got it wrong a little bit, from 2003 to 2015, and then they came up with something in 2015 that replaced it with another fix to or another change to physician reimbursements. But the concept still remains because of the PAYGO policy that we were talking about earlier. But it's still somewhat temporary. There's nothing permanent in place to stop the cutting of payments to providers that offer Medicare services. This SGR, by the way, stands for Sustainable Growth Rate. It's just a formula that says, hey, to keep Medicare costs down, we're going to, like, pay doctors less money. And every year they say, we can't do that. We're going to lose the doctors. And they just override it. So that went on for 12 years. And then they came up with something that's slightly different, but still there is a risk to reducing Medicare reimbursements to doctors, and that's a problem for all of those on Medicare, that because their doctors may just drop Medicare and say, I can't do it anymore. It's already lower relative to commercial rates. On the C-Spire text line, here's the thing. Democrats have no reason to believe Republicans are negotiating in good faith. They used rescissions to remove previously negotiated items from that'd be prior Congresses. Why would they believe it would be different this time? Well, it's possible that they see it as, hey, why do we want to work with you here to get this continuing resolution passed to keep the government open? If we know that you're inclined to pass legislation in the future that essentially rescinds or revokes prior agreed to spending. That's no doubt. But I think you got to look beyond that. You always got to think about the political motivation here, right? The political motivation is the Democrats are convinced that first we got to go out and fight, and let it be known that we're fighting to keep these enhanced subsidies in place. Just more government dollars going into the pockets of these 24 million Americans that get their coverage from the exchanges. That's number one. Number two is they're thinking about how if the Republicans don't agree to extend the enhanced subsidies, how they can use that to their benefit in the midterms. These guys are the reason your health insurance went up. And even though it's only 24 million people in the country, depends on where they are, right, and how they could affect the elections in the various districts and states at the Senate level. It's all a political calculation, as is this all the time. It's always about the next election cycle. And that's what they're thinking of right now. How can we hang this on the Republicans? They're the ones that caused your health care and premiums to go up. And Donald Trump promised that he would address the cost of living, and he's not doing that because your health care premiums are going up. All that's absolutely true. It's just a matter of, well, what do you want? You want to be more fiscally responsible, or do you want lower cost and just continue to kick the can down the road and not really worry about the deficit and the debt and just continue down that road? That's what we're dealing with. Paul in Meridian says seniors and disabled should be a priority. I think he's talking about in the event of a government shutdown. And yeah, I agree, but the reality is, Paul, everybody's got a pain point, and no matter what happens, you remember Barack Obama when that happened, and he shut down the national parks, and there was some big World War II event happening, and they couldn't get to the various monuments. Remember that, Will? I mean, it was like, this isn't a lot of money, but it was to impose maximum pain to make a point, because it was all politics. Of course, yeah. It's all politics. So Paul says we don't have insurance to write a check and we go to a doctor. Well, God bless you, Paul, that you have that ability. I pray that you don't have some major medical event that would be incredibly expensive. I talked to Will, a friend, Friday afternoon after the show, that had some major medical treatment done. $1.7 million is what it costs. Most people can't write a check for $1.7 million.
They can't, and as you know, the cost, the actual cost for the hospital is, it varies wildly.
Yeah.
Between, for the same treatment.
Yep.
We had to pay out of pocket for something, my family did, a few years ago. And so we got a cash price.
Yeah.
And you would have thought I asked the lady to stand on her head and present this information to me. She looked at me like I was so dumb. You want to know what it actually costs? I mean,
that's a problem.
And they didn't know it, Gerard. It took them several days.
Yeah, that's
it was over a week to estimate what the actual cash for a common procedure. I'm not talking about some crazy thing where you had to, you know, fly in scientists from all over the world. I'm talking about a normal procedure they do every single day, multiple times a day. And they didn't know. And the cost between Hospital A and Hospital B had a comma in it. Just put it that way.
Unbelievable.
It blew my mind that they didn't know that. Which tells me that, you know, all the stuff that we have for every other market, every other service, product, etc., doesn't apply.
It's, agree. And that it is a problem in the healthcare industry in this country that you often don't know what stuff costs till after it's already been done. I think that's how most people find out.
I remember
about it.
Going through the bill, and we got billed for a whole box of gloves. Okay?
Yeah.
The price, I could have gone down to Walgreens and got them, you know, for.
That's because you're paying for all the people who don't. That's the reality. That's the year. They're just passing that on to you. We got half an hour of middays remaining after this break. We're in the Element Well studio.
From the Seabrook.
Okay, so why is it missing some of the vocals there, that particular version?
I don't know. Maybe they were on some stuff.
The background
vocals
are missing.
Maybe they were on some stuff on it.
I think that's some weird recording we got there.
And them papas, you never know.
Thomas in Greenwood says his life's not worth $1.7 million, just so you'll know. He said, $1.7 million, just put me down. There's no treatment worth that much. Okay. So you, how much is your life worth, Thomas? What if it were your child? Your child's life's not worth that much? Man. So the Godfather says we need true fiscal conservative leadership to halt the outrageous government spending. And I know everybody says that, and I'm with them. What do you want to cut? You want to cut Social Security and Medicare? That's 35% of spending. And you could say, well, just root out all the waste, fraud, and abuse. How much time and money did the Doge people spend in there trying to root all that out? They didn't come up with much at the end of the day.
In the grand scheme of things.
It just didn't amount to anything. I mean, it's peanuts. Not even peanuts. Wasn't that much. In fact, the trajectory's still going up, even after their changes were implemented, which were minor at best.
You have to change fundamental things like the fact that, you know, what you pay into Social Security, you're going to get a lot more on the other side.
Medicare's the one that's really upside down. You're right, though, in that respect. And the main proposal that seems to get a little interest from both sides is to lift the cap. The Democrats have been proposing this for a long time. Scrap the cap is their battle cry. Bernie Sanders, Liz Warren, Schumer, AOC. And that just means that all wages above $176,000, which is the current cap, would be subject to Social Security taxes going into the Social Security program, but benefits would remain the same. So you'd pay a whole lot more in at the upper end of the income scale, but the benefits you receive out would not increase. So essentially, those at the higher end of the income scale are paying for the benefits of others. It's the way that works. You got to pay a whole lot more in there, Mr. High Wage Earner, but you're not getting any more out. It's welfare. It becomes welfare.
Mm-hmm.
We're currently exceeding the amount of money paid in. It's a pay-as-you-go system. That's how it was designed. That's why the trust fund is just essentially a savings account is being depleted because not enough's coming in from those working to pay the benefits from those receiving them. And the total benefits, by the way, of our $7 trillion of spending, $1.6 trillion of that, just under $1.6 going to Social Security.
Wow.
The government should not be in the health care business. I agree. This person says, cut it all, start over, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. Social Security's a scam. Tell that to the millions of people receiving Social Security benefits. I mean, if you just cut it and said do away with it, then you got no money coming in to pay the benefits, then all the people who are receiving benefits who paid in all their lives would get zero. Is that fair? I don't think that would be very popular. And the same for Medicare. So we could debate and argue all day long about whether or not the government made a good decision in creating those programs. Social Security 1935 and Medicare and Medicaid 1965, but they're in place, and unwinding those would be difficult, would be painful. I've seen some proposals that say, hey, everybody under 40, you're no longer in Social Security, you don't pay into it, and scrap the cap and have everybody that makes more income pay into it and just sort of phase it out, except the numbers don't work. The math doesn't even come close to working in that respect. And then what do you do to the people under 40 who've been paying in during their working career? You got to get them paid back. I've seen some proposals. Well, just pay it back to them over 10 years. Who would want that? Wait. You're gonna make me wait 10 years to get the money back I paid in? I got to build a retirement. It's hard to do that when you're getting money back over a 10-year period as opposed to deploying that money to go to work right now for the ultimate day when I retire. So it's all this is just a problem, and I don't see. I know here's the old. Who just sent this? I just made foreign aid. Sure, foreign aid. It's $40 billion a year. $40 billion. In $7 trillion. It's less than 1%. It's about 0.5%. It's peanuts. It's 3.5 days of spending. On the other side, the Democrats say, well, just confiscate all the billionaires' wealth. That gets you about 9 months. I mean, that's how significant and serious and monumental the numbers are. Unless you're talking trillions, you're not talking about real money. make it optional. Sure, we make it optional. That means the program shuts down today. You understand that, that you made Social Security optional to people coming into the workforce? That means the money's not coming in to pay benefits. You're not paying for your benefits. You're paying for somebody else's. And when you retire, they're paying for yours. That's the pay-as-you-go defined benefit system.
I'm currently paying for what grandma
Correct.
Is getting.
There's no account with Will East's name on it up there,
yeah.
So you'll know. Now, what I mean is there's no money sitting aside.
Yeah.
That's got your.
They don't have a little lockbox going, well, Will's money's up in there.
It's you and the other 180 million that are paying into it all going into one big pot because it's irrelevant because your benefits aren't based on that. Your benefits aren't based on how much you paid in. They're based on how much you make over the 10 years prior to you retiring and how many years you paid in. That's what it's based on, not how much you paid in. That's why you can lift the cap and not raise benefits. You just keep the benefit program the same because the amount you pay in is irrelevant. Only the number of years you work and the amount you are making, and there's caps on that. It's designed to replace your income over a 10-year, your average income over a 10-year period, I should say. I disagree with the statement that was just made. If I could have invested 15.3% put in Social Security over the years, I would have far more in my account of Social Security. I totally agree. I didn't disagree with that whatsoever. But that's not what we have. We can argue again about whether what happened in 1935 was a good decision, a good policy. But that's not how it works. And remember, I have to remind folks of this, it was originally called social insurance. It was insurance against the outside chance you may live to be 65. It wasn't a retirement program. It was never designed to be a retirement. That's why it's broke, because it's being used for something it was never created to produce. It was the life expectancy of a male was 59 in 1935, 61 for a female. On the outside chance you made it past those years, 265, okay, we've got a program for you. It was actually an anti-poverty program. You can't work anymore. You're 65. We don't want you to be poor. Here's a little money to keep you from being poor. The very first Social Security recipient, Ida Mae Fuller, she paid in $24. She received out $22,000.
And there you go.
That's all you need to know.
From the first person.
Very first person. Lived to be 100.
It was in the red.
Very first person. Paid in 24, got out 22,000.
She lived to be 100?
100.
Wow.
Unheard of. First recipient. She got check 0000001. There's pictures of her. You can go look at it right now.
One of the best investments of all time. She paid in, you said $24.
$24.
$24,
got over 3 years, I think. Yeah. Got 22,000 out. Yeah, I'm with you, but Wayne, I wish I could have invested my money in the way I see fit. And George H. Bush tried to do that, so-called privatization. The problem is the vast majority of people, Will, don't know how to invest money. And you know what would end up happening? They would squander it. They'd get taken advantage of by crooks.
Yeah.
They'd squander it, and then no retirement. That's why that was objected to.
I mean, but eventually something like that's going to have to happen.
Yeah. If Social Security, what I would like to see happen immediately is that Social Security could invest in assets other than what it is restricted to presently, which is just what are called S bonds, special bonds. The average interest rate on the special bonds right now, 3.5%. So that's the return. 3.5%. And if you analyses have been done that shows, man, if we'd have done what George H. Bush wanted to do and allowed Social Security to invest in private securities other than just the special bonds, and you look at the S&P return since then, we wouldn't even be having this conversation. But the Democrats objected to it then on this this concern that, oh, my gosh, they don't know what to invest in. They make wrong investments, and we lose all the money. But here's the rationale for it, in my view, that I think refutes that. PERS, our state employee retirement system, all the other states and their retirement systems, they're all allowed. And they only work because they are allowed to invest in private securities.
Yeah.
That's the only way, because we have an 8-9% average return in PERS over the last 10 years compared to Social Security's 3.5. And PERS is broke, even with that. Final segment next.
Poly up a Mississippi.
Welcome back, everyone. It's Middays. So, let's see. I'm looking here. Somebody sent something to me, and I told them I would address it, but now I can't find it. It scrolled above me here, so still looking for it. Oh, yeah. Here we go. It's Matthew from Oxford. He identified himself. Appreciate that, Matthew. So tell me if this is dumb or not. I think the federal government should cut federal Medicaid by 5% per year for the next 10 years, and Social Security should be cut off from new recipients for persons age 50 or younger with existing recipients, and people 50 or older entitled to Social Security as normal, but with all persons under age 49, their lifetime Social Security payments, they would get them back either in a lump sum or in yearly payments with accrued interest, with the goal of balancing the budget and to shift more responsibility onto people themselves to plan for retirement health care, since the country is in completely different shape than when these programs were introduced. Yeah, it won't work. Here's why. If you said, like I was saying earlier, Will, if we just said that in this case, everyone 49 or younger, you're no longer Social Security. You don't have to pay into it anymore. Immediately, the program can't make its full benefit payments. I can't emphasize that enough. It's a pay-as-you-go system. It's everything coming in that you were currently paying all goes out the door. And it's not being saved up for you.
If you stop the paying in part,
yeah,
the rest.
Yeah, it's a $1.5 trillion a year program. We take in about $1.4. If everybody under 50 stopped paying in, we pay in about $300. Where are we going to get the other trillion to pay the benefits? We have to go borrow it, which means we're adding to our debt. It's not an easy solution. I know. And I wish something like that, it would be that easy. But it's not, again, because of the pay-as-you-go nature. You're not paying in for yourself. You're paying in for people who are currently receiving benefits.
Yeah.
That's how, just like Ida Mae Fuller paid in $24. That obviously didn't cover her $22,000 she received out. No, the people who were working and paying into Social Security while she was retired for 35 years. That's, she paid in 3 years and received benefits for 35.
Yep.
So I wish that would work. Now, with respect to Medicaid, you know, that was passed, of course, in 1965. That is currently a $620 billion a year program from the federal government. And then, of course, you get the money that comes from the, at the state level. So right here in Mississippi, we get $8 billion a year from the federal government for Medicaid. We contribute at the state level about $1 billion. Actually, it's the federal is somewhere between 7 and 8. We hadn't quite hit the 8, but it's growing. So we have 750,000 Mississippians on Medicaid. That's without expansion. It's an $8 billion a year program. It's bigger than our entire general fund budget. Medicaid is. So we could certainly cut it, but then what would happen here at the state level is a whole lot of people wouldn't have health insurance. 750,000 who are currently on it wouldn't have it. Or the state could say, okay, we'll cover the federal government's portion. Well, where are we going to come up with $7 billion? That's the exact amount we collect now in taxes that goes into the state general fund, about $7 billion, $7.5 billion to be exact. So I'm okay, honestly, with phasing out the federal Medicaid program and sending all of that responsibility to the states, both in terms of funding and just what the program looks like, just the policies around the program, who qualifies, what the reimbursement rates. But it means we'd have a huge, huge financial burden on our state that honestly wouldn't work. It's nice to talk about federalism, and I'm all for that, of course. And it's nice to talk about welfare and the welfare state. I shouldn't say it's nice. It's something that we need to talk about, and we do a lot here in the state of Mississippi. We're a more conservative state. But the fact is we are heavily dependent on the deep blue Democrat blue states for our very existence, and that's what's got to change. We've got to wean ourselves off such strong federal dependence. We get the most money as a percentage of our total education budget, by the way, than any other state. It comes from the federal government. It's about 25%. And with respect to Medicaid, we get the highest federal match. The combination of those two is off the charts, how much federal money we get because we're poor, because we're the most impoverished state. That's how both of those programs work with respect to federal funding to the state level. That's what we got to fix, and the only way to do that is to grow the state's economy. It's the only way to start keeping the highly educated, highly compensated college grads that all leave our state after we pay for their education to a great extent. We're out of here today. Back with you again tomorrow. Stay safe and God bless.
Super Talk Mississippi Media Production.